Hello and welcome to Escape into Storytelling. I'm Jennifer Bradley, and this is a chapter from my self-published novel, Virago. New episodes drop each Monday, and all chapters will be available at the end of the book. Virago is intended for a mature audience, and today's episode contains language and alcohol use. If you missed last week's episode, it is available from the same podcast source. Now please, sit back and escape into storytelling with me in today's episode. Chapter 23. Burning leaves is discussed. Gordon considers a risk. Neville takes a fall. In the audience chamber at the academy, the librarian held court. Her strange voice filled the vast room, ringing in the ears of the listeners when she spoke, filling them with eerie silence when she paused. One of today's questions had been about the origin of the Glendale Festival of Burning Leaves. Adelaide stood next to Lance, intent on the speaker.
The holiday known as Burning Leaves marks the end of the Empire's reign and the beginning of Vetral as its own country. It is a time of rebirth and renewal, and also ends the Vitralese calendar year.
This is the interesting part, Lance said, whispering in Adelaide's ear.
In the week before the Empire fell, the 12-year-old Duchess wrote a poem. It was short and easily remembered. Gather round the pyres, break out the ashes old. Thursday we shall have some fires. Summer has grown cold. Long night comes to an end. All visitors must away. Tell me you shall be my friend to start this fine new day. She commanded her palace guard to memorize it and begin spreading it through the city to willing ears. The poem was said in pubs, the market, crossroads, and anywhere people hostile to the Empire congregated. The poem's meaning was this: meet at the Summer Palace on Thursday night at sundown. The people were unsure why they were there, but they did so. They met and passed the time singing songs or chatting in the cool autumn air. As dark drew on, copper bells sent out forces to break up the crowds. The imperial soldiers banged swords against their tower shields as they chanted, "Disperse! Disperse!" They marched along the Weldon Road to the Summer Palace and faced the crowd. The crowd didn't move. Instead, it began to surround the soldiers, and then attacked them. Hidden within the crowd were the armored palace guard with their swords. The palace guard was supposed to shout, "Long live King Paradis!" Over and over, they were told of the importance of this detail, that it was crucial for the people to understand who had really fomented the revolution and freed them from the empire. Instead, Jeremiah Bedloe, captain of the palace guard and loyal only to the Duchess, instructed his troops to shout something else. An old man raised his hand in the air.
"Long live the lady!"
The crowd took up the cry. Soon the hall rang with their voices. The librarian smiled.
With the help of the people, the palace guard stormed the Summer Palace. The emperor's distant cousin, Gaucis Travasso, who was ruling Vetral at that time, was taken and executed along with his inner circle. The remaining imperial garrison fled from the city. The crowds broke into archives where the empire stored records of taxes, debts, certificates of indentured servitude, loans, and everything else that had required an imperial stamp. They burned it all. Around the city, the same thing was happening. Ledgers, contracts, accounts, everything was thrown onto pyres. The glowing pages blew into the air, dancing on the thermals and resembled burning leaves. The only documents that survived were those housed in the Library of the Dead.
Again, the Latay fell silent. Adelaide frowned.
She looks sad.
The great golden eyes blinked.
The audience is over.
As the room cleared, Adelaide and Lance headed to the reading rooms for her afternoon lesson.
Total disaster, Lance said, scratching his ear.
What?
Burning all the records. Complete disaster. People's property was stolen if they couldn't prove ownership. And there were riots and all kinds of bad things. A lot of the people breaking into those buildings couldn't even read. They couldn't tell tax records from history books. Madame Yerevny thinks that's what led to the troubled times. Well, that and all the famines and diseases.
Lance opened a side door leading into a small hallway. History's complicated like that. Even the good things can be bad if you look at them close enough. The reading room was deserted and stuffy. Lance opened the windows while Adelaide spread some of her latest practice papers across the tables. As fresh paper was expensive, she worked on a variety of scavenged surfaces, and each retained old smells of their previous lives, creating scent associations with her grammar exercises. A poem describing a house, which included all the letters of the Vitrolese alphabet, sprawled across brown butcher's paper that smelled of pork. A list of Vitral's largest cities still carried an aroma of tea leaves. Countries bordering the Sandoval were listed on a discarded page from Gert's ledger, which he'd tossed aside after spilling coffee on it. She looked up at the keystone over the door and the words carved into the marble. Lance followed her line of sight and grinned at her.
What's it say?
Know the world within and without.
Excellent, excellent.
He walked to the table and lifted some of the scraps of paper. And now let's see what you've been working on.
If I leave you to lock up, will you be all right?
Hobson asked, rubbing his running nose with a rag. He'd been coughing and sneezing most of the day and looked half dead on his feet. Nearly every customer he'd served at Rounds had asked why he didn't just go home.
I'll be fine.
Neville put clean mugs on the shelf under the bar. He became aware of a silence and turned to find the old barman watching him.
He's not sure he can trust me. I've never closed alone before.
Caught, Hobson started and nodded.
All right, then, I'm off.
He hung up the ancient stained apron on its hook.
He might as well have come out and said it. I'm taking a big gamble on you. Don't screw it up.
Rounds was deserted, but for a group of young people in the corner. One girl wore the boiled leather armor and insignia of a journeyman East Coast watch member. The rest were around her age. All were trying a round of Hobson's dark lager. From their talk, Neville gathered they were celebrating her recent promotion. He went back to cleaning the mugs.
Me in a watch pub. Who'd have thought? But they aren't so bad. They behave, and when they don't, other watch members deal with it. I barely have to lift a finger.
The little group left, nodding to him on their way out. Only the journeyman finished her drink. The other five mugs were at least three quarters full when Neville came to clear the table. Two mugs went onto the tray he carried, sloshing their dark contents. Smells of heady dark lager, all chocolates and malts and a tiny bit of burned bread, rose to him. Underneath the mugs were several coins.
Well, well, a little tip.
He grinned and the coins went into his pocket. He shook his head at the third mug, still full.
Just kids. Probably like them yellow ales like they do down south. Hobson's mash was too much for them.
The third mug went into his mouth, followed by the fourth. His eyes widened. The fifth mug nearly went onto the floor. Swearing, he set the mugs on the tray and hurried to dump them out. After he rinsed them and replaced them under the bar, he busied himself with other tasks. He was locking the front door when he felt it hit. He'd downed nearly a quart of Hobson's dark lager after months of nothing,
And it caught up fast. He staggered sideways, hit a table with his hip, tripped, and sprawled. Although it had been some time since his last drink, he was still a veteran of the condition. On the floor, he had his bearings.
Crawl to the backyard. Get some water barrel, in the back. I'll throw up over the fence so he doesn't see anything.
The fence in question stood at the edge of the cliff face. Below was 20 feet of stony slope and another row of houses and shops. Cold air hit him, but still the world corkscrewed away. He held on to the door jamb, then dropped to the ground and rolled onto his back. Thinned by winter, the grass blades were prickly under his hands. Overhead, the stars of the mare glittered.
"She always brings you home safely," Grandfather said.
He rolled over. He crawled to the fence.
"No. No, I will not stick my head through that fence and puke like a cow with its head stuck in a bush. I'll stand and do it like a man."
He pulled himself to his feet. As his hands wrapped around the fence, it relieved itself of several splinters, which he did not, at the moment, notice. He leaned forward and fell. When Gray's ragged hands appeared on the castle's windowsill, Gordon was waiting. Wrapped in layers of wool and velvet against the chill that crept in, Gordon sprawled on a small divan, his legs crossed at the ankle. 3 fingertips held the rim of a glass of mulled wine, which he swirled slowly just above the floor. The shrouded, hooded head rose into view and took in the scene.
"Good evening." "It is, isn't it?"
Broad shoulders followed the head, and Gray turned to sit on the sill. As casually as if he were on a garden bench, the man turned and rested one leg on the sill, allowing the other to dangle over hundreds of feet of nothing. Although the city lay under a smoky sheet from fires banked against the cold, the castle rose above all. The air here was clear and fresh, the night sky black and glistening as hot tar. The mare's eye winked. Gray's hooded head fixed on a constellation.
"Do you ever wonder what it's all about?"
Gordon rolled his eyes.
"Gods, not philosophy. Let's talk history. What the hell happened to Darkseid last week?" "Ah, the explosion."
Gordon eyed the man. "Did something else happen that I care about?"
Perhaps. Oh, well, do business then."
The figure swung his leg over the stonework and faced Gordon. He rested his hands on his thighs.
"What did your little spook tell you?"
Is he asking because he doesn't know what happened himself? Perhaps he's trying to find something else out. Something about Victor?
You first.
Gray shrugged.
"Very well. The explosion came from some potions. These kinds of potions don't travel well at the best of times, and this one had been dropped."
"So?"
Gray indicated the half-full bottle of wine on the floor near the divan.
"If I may."
Gordon shrugged. The ragged figure slid off a sill and crossed the room in a heartbeat. It stuck its disgusting thumb in the mouth of the bottle and gave it a good shake.
"That was my last bottle of Port Mountain Red."
"Shut up."
The bottle was lifted into view and turned this way and that.
"See the bubbles? They form when liquids are shaken."
He set down the wine and returned to the sill.
"The bubbles in our potion change when they form. They create a vapor in the top of the bottle. If the vapor sits for too long, it becomes quite powerful. The mixing master knew. His assistants didn't. They dropped the crate but didn't tell him.
The vapor had been building up for days. And then? Some fool lit a shallopipe and blew them all to hell. You never forget your first fireball, assuming you survive anyway. Gordon nodded.
Victor has them down in the dungeons.
Gray waved a hand. He has somebody down there, although I've no idea who. Just some gutter rats who live near the building. I know exactly who was working in that basement.
How?
Because I hired them. Gordon sat up and swung his feet onto the floor.
What? What for?
The figure chuckled.
My dear man, do you really think you're my only customer in this city?
What does that mean? Do I dare even ask?
Well, what were they making?
Do you really want to know?
Gordon's mouth opened.
Do I? What then? Who would I tell? I'm in this now. Ever since those thumbprints showed up with breakfast. I'm in this.
No.
Excellent.
I don't think you need to know either.
Gray stretched his arms overhead, rolling his head back on his shoulders. For a moment his hands were in the air, his face averted.
Push him. Push him now.
His pulse doubling at the thought, Gordon shifted on the divan and then sat back. Gray's head lowered. Within the hood, the eyes gleamed.
No. Not even going to try. I wouldn't have blamed you, although I would have killed you.
He leaned forward, resting one hand on his leg as the other pointed over his shoulder.
A fall of several hundred feet goes fast. To everyone but the one falling, to them it takes a long, long time.
Fascinating.
Gray held up a hand.
Do you have anything for me?
Gordon chewed his lip, then jerked his head toward his desk.
Top drawer.
Gray chortled to himself as he crossed the room.
You haven't gone and booby-trapped the drawer, I hope. No spring-loaded needles or bladders of poison gas.
He opened the drawer at a glacial pace, producing a prolonged, nerve-wracking scrape. At sight of the sack of coins and scroll inside, he shook his head.
Dear me, I'm disappointed.
Yes, well.
Gordon leaned back and sipped his wine. He waved a hand toward the window.
Ah, yes, indeed. The servant has served and is now excused.
Gray headed for the window. He paused, one foot on the sill.
I've heard a great deal about this burning leaves thing that's coming up.
What is it?
Gordon shrugged. A yearly tradition, part of New Year's celebrations. The people write things on sky lanterns and send them off from the cliffs and docks.
What do they write?
Wishes, hopes. Pfft. He swirled his glass. Usual nonsense. It's a wonder the city hasn't burned down a dozen times by now.
Interesting. I wonder what would be written on Main Gordon's lantern. Perhaps I'll find out.
Then he was gone. In her little room over the shop, Adelaide sat cross-legged on her bed. Various types of paper, parchment, vellum, even scraps of wrapping paper from bolts of fabric, lay around her. An evolving chicken scratch covered most of them. The earliest looked as if someone had flung charcoal at the paper from across the room. The most recent examples were covered with carefully drawn loops and lines that made up common vitriolese script. She bit her finger as her eyes moved over the progress. She picked up the latest entry, a thick piece of yellowed parchment discarded from Gert's old accounting ledgers.
I'm Adelaide, a
I sew in a shop. I live in East Coast. I came from the high country. Lance burst out laughing when I showed him this. I wonder why. Another note had a phrase repeated over and over. Hereabouts lay the village of Inarritu, destroyed sometime between 91 and 93. The completed phrase was now inked on Yerevni's giant map of Vitral, in Adelaide's own hand. I can't wait to see this festival. Gert and Alan are watching it in Westmont, but I'll get to see Luthus, and Miriam and everyone from the Bell is going. It's going to be so much fun. Yerevni said she'd come, and... Her head snapped up. Footsteps were creeping around the back of the shop, on the patio. She curled her lip and rose. Halfway down the stairs, she heard a soft knock. Black bands of hair moved across her skin. Knocking doesn't mean it's anyone I know. Could be a would-be robber or rapist, knocking to see if anyone's home, or to bring me to the door so they can burst in. The curled lip became a grim smile by the time she reached the door.
Ah, gods, don't do that!
At the sight of her shining eyes, Neville nearly fell over backward. Her lips twitched into a grin as her teeth shrank. How was I to know who was out here? She took in the state of his clothes, of the scrapes on his arm and torn knee of his pants. What happened? Were you in a fight?
Sort of. Had a little fall.
He smells like ale, but he's not drunk. She invited him inside, and as she did with any guests, they sat on opposite ends of her bed. Her notes remained strewn between them. He reached into his pocket. His hand emerged, displaying four circles of silver that caught the candlelight.
There's the rest of what I owed you.
I don't need or want it, but it's important to him. She pocketed the money. It all seems so long ago. Remember our first day in town? A little laugh escaped him.
Carver ran up wanting money before I even had my shoes off.
Aye. How's he doing? I haven't seen him for a time now.
Me neither. Fine, as far as I know.
His eye wandered over the little room. Besides the bed, there was a wardrobe missing its doors, where her clothing lay neatly folded. A few other knick-knacks sat on its shelves. A clay sculpture of a bird, some plates and cups, her shoes. One object caught his eye and brought a smile to his lips. A leather thong was hung on a bent nail, and from it dangled a wooden comb.
That all feels like a lifetime ago.
I barely have any thing of mine left after I sold it all. I'm glad she kept that. Are you doing anything for Burning Leaves? Broken from his reverie, he cocked his head.
Just work. Hobson stays open for it since his place is right near where people set the lanterns off. We're putting out tables for people.
A ghost of his old grin rose on his lips.
You should come by. I'll get you a round on me.
Are you sure? I'll have a lot of people with me. The grin slipped.
Ah, well, in that case, I can maybe get you a discount.
Gordon wrapped his warm velvets around himself, enjoying the cozy fabric pressing against him. The rest of the table members were bundled in furs, velvets, scarves, and wools, and a bright, cheerful fire burned in the fireplace behind Alistair. Hot tea was being passed around, as well as warm buttered bread with a springy white cheese that melted in the mouth.
And what really makes it cozy in here is that empty stool in the alcove. We're missing one spymaster today.
I suppose I should be more worried when I don't know where the creepy bastard is.
What's worse, the spider that's crawled on your hand, or the spider you fling off and might be lurking anywhere in the room?
Alistair was congratulating the captain of East Coast on his latest heroic exploit. Due to the cold weather, East Coast had seen an increase in fires. Winston's men had been running themselves ragged putting them out, and the elderly East Coast fire wagon had finally fallen apart.
Maybe he's smarter than I thought. I'm the one who refused them funding for a new wagon, but he hasn't looked at me once.
A stupid man would be glaring at me the whole time. But he's not. And that idea of his wasn't bad either. Rather than wait for fires to happen and try to run across town with sand in buckets, Winston ordered barrels of sand placed throughout East Coast. They were painted bright yellow so they were easy to see by someone in a panicked state. Likewise, the inhabitants' rain barrels that were mostly empty due to the dry weather were filled with water and painted yellow. Extra barrels were stored near aqueduct fountains, also painted yellow, and the promise of a heavy fine had prevented the barrels' theft. Several fires were stopped before they got out of hand, and Winston earned himself a special commendation from the table.
I have to admit, it's at least showing some forethought. Though why no one thought of it before, I can't imagine.
The captain's huge chest was thrust out, and Alasdair shook his hand, along with Jehan Plowright and a few other lackeys. Gordon lost interest in watching the show, and his bored eye drifted to the little man sitting at a makeshift desk against the wall.
Victor might not be here, but his little clerk never misses a trick.
The man was studiously bent over a parchment, his quill scratching like a chicken on an anthill. Jehan Plowright cleared his throat.
"I have a matter on which I would speak, Your Grace,"
Plowright said, leaning forward in his chair. Alistair gave his assent, and Plowright rose to stand before the table.
"Gods hear me. Please keep this short, whatever it is."
"Good friends of the table, I pray you listen. I speak on a matter of great importance, of which I've spoken before, and one very personal to me. Of course you know my lineage is Hwathi, so I shall be biased in how I approach the matter. But is it not also biased to be against something only because you've always been against it?"
"Yes, that is the definition of biased," Gordon thought sourly.
"Just the other day, we spoke of the recently arrived Hwathi and their tattoos. I would ask that you listen to the reasoning behind their markings before you make up your mind on the matter."
"Some kind of tribal thing, isn't it?" Lord Galbraith offered. "Or family? Clans?"
"Yes, that's what I've always thought," Lady Renee Orswell said, nodding.
"Indeed. But it's more complex than that. The Hwathi have been seafarers since before the Warosans stepped into the water. They moved from island to island with no more thought than a child crossing a stream on stepstones. Some tribes alternate islands the way a farmer rotates his crops. One year they spend here, cultivating the land, before moving on. The thin soil replenishes itself in the meantime."
"Fascinating, Plowright. Is there a point coming?"
Alistair said, drumming his fingers on the tabletop. Plowright nodded.
"There is, Your Grace. Better than most, the Hwathi know the ocean can be treacherous. They know when a soul is lost at sea, those left behind hang on to hope, and sometimes let hope worry them to the end of their days. So the Hwathi mark themselves. Their tattoos identify where they were born, who their people are, and their name, so that if a body is found, it might be given proper burial. Before surrendering themselves to the vagaries of the sea, they write in the hopes the words will lead their names home to their families, even if they do not survive themselves." He paused.
"Well done, Plowright. You ought to be on the stage."
"Ladies and gentlemen, I beg you reconsider this notion that tattoos are only worn by slaves, gang members, or pirates. Further, that you reconsider the idea that the Hwathi must abandon their customs in order to be true citizens of the city. Would we ask the Warosans to give up their nobiks?"
He folded his hands behind his back.
"Yes, at one time we needed to reduce the influx of people. During the troubled times, we were swollen with people, unable to feed our own, and with chaos reigning in the streets. Worse, slaves escaping from the Empire landed on our shores in hopes of sanctuary, and at the time we were averse to challenging the Empire outright, so we sent them back. We outlawed tattoos. But times have changed. We've seen no marked slaves for more than 20 years from the Empire. And yet this piece of outdated legislation endures. Think on it, I beg you. And when we can reconvene in a few days, I pray you will make the right decision. He gave a curt, respectful nod, and then returned to his seat. Alistair knocked on the table.
Most moving, Lord Plowright. I shall think carefully on the matter myself. Whew, a most productive meeting, I'd say. One captain implements a brilliant new strategy for fighting fires, another has reduced crime. What a godsend that Bedloe has been for us, eh? I could use a few more like these two.
Bedloe, too, missed his calling on the stage. I've never seen such bold-faced lies spewed with utter confidence. I don't know how the man sleeps at night. Probably quite well in his house in Westmont now I think about it. Inside his warm, fleece-lined boots, Gordon clenched his toes, reveling in the feel of silken socks. This concludes Chapter 23 of Virago. Stay tuned for the next episode, Chapter 24, in which three very different meetings are held. If you want to read along, Virago will be available in abridged print or ebook format from Amazon later this year. If you enjoyed this work, please remember to like, share, and subscribe so you never miss an episode of Escape into Storytelling. Thank you for supporting independent and self-published authors like me. Until next time, be seeing you.